This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by P.C. Yearsley. Yeah. his head, but did nothing with her himself. But Sophie, a firearm stamp album, or a clasp knife with three blades and gold spring. He sat down to think better. But it was no use. He could only think of things the others would not have cared for, such as a football or a pair of leg gloves, or to be able to lick some kin's miners thoroughly when he went back to school. Well, said the Samian at last, you'd better hurry up with that wish of yours. Time flies. I know it does, said Robert. I can't think what to wish for. I wish you could give one of the others their wish, without their having to come here to ask for it. Oh, don't! But it was too late. The Samoyed had blown itself out to about three times its proper size, and now it collapsed like a crimped buckle, and with a deep sigh, leaned back against the edge of its sand pool, quite faint with the effort. There, it said in a weak voice, it was tremendously hard, but I did it. Run along home. Well, they're sure to wish for something silly before you get there. They were quite sure, Robert felt this. And as he ran home, his mind was deeply occupied with the sort of wishes he might find they had wished in his absence. He might wish for rabbits, or white mice, or chocolate, or a fine day tomorrow, or even, and that was most likely, someone might have said, I do wish to goodness Robert would hurry up. But he was hurrying up, and so they would have their wish. And the day would be wasted. Then he tried to think what they could wish for. Something that would be amusing indoors. That had been his own difficulty from the beginning. So few things are amusing indoors when the sun is shining outside, and you might go out however much you want to. Robert was running as fast as he could, but when he turned the corner, the bolster brought him within sight of the architect's nightmare, the ornamental ironwork on the top of the house. He opened his eyes so wide that he had to drop into a walk, so you cannot run with your eyes wide open. Then suddenly he stopped short, for there was no house to be seen. The front garden railings were gone too, and where the house had stood, Robert rubbed his eyes and looked again. Yes, the others had wished. There was no doubt about that. They must have wished that they lived in a castle. For there the castle stood, black and stately, and very tall and broad, with battlements and lancet windows and eight great towers, and where the garden and the orchard had been, there were white things dotted like mushrooms. Robert walked slowly on, and as he got nearer, he saw that these were tents, and men in armor were walking about them. Finch is just like that sand fairy. Thou should never see the beastly thing. As the little window above the great gateway, across the moat that now lay with a garden had been but half an hour ago, someone was waving something, pale, dust-covered. Robert thought it was one of Cyril's handkerchiefs. They had never been white since the day when he had upset the bottle of combined toning and fixing solution into the drawer where they were. Robert waved back and immediately felt that he had been unwise, for his signal had been seen by the besieging force and two men in steel caps were coming towards him. They had high brown boots on their long legs, and they came towards him with such great strides that Robert remembered the shortness of his own legs and did not run away. He knew it would be useless to himself, and he feared it might be irritating to the foe. So he stood still, and the two men seemed quite pleased with him. "By my helmet," said one, "a brave varlet this." Robert felt pleased at being called brave, and somehow it made him feel brave. He passed over the varlet. It was the way people talked in historical romances to the young, he knew, and it was evidently not meant for rudeness. He only hoped he would be able to understand what they said to him. He had not always been able quite to follow the conversations in historical romances for the young. "His garb is strange," said the other. "Some outlandish treachery belike. Say, lad, what brings you hither?" Robert knew this meant nothing, youngster. "What are you up to, hey?" So he said, "If you please, I want to go home." "Go then," said the man in the longest boots. "None hindereth, and naught lets us to follow. Six," he added in a cautious undertone. "I misdoubt me, but he bears tidings to the besieged. Where dwellest thou, young knave?" inquired the man with the largest steel cap. "Over there," said Robert, and directly he had said it, he knew he ought to have said, "Yonder." "Ha! Sayest so," rejoined the longest boots. "Come hither, boy. This is a matter for our leader." And to the leader, Robert was dragged forthwith by the reluctant ear. The leader was the most glorious creature Robert had ever seen. He was exactly like the pictures Robert had so often admired in the historical romances. He had armor, and a helmet, and a horse, and a crest, and feathers, and a shield, and a lance, and a sword. His armor and his weapons were all, I'm almost sure, of quite different periods. The shield was 13th century, while the sword was because of the present use in the Peninsular War. The cuirass was of the time of Charles I, and the helmet dated from the Second Crusade. The arms and the shield were very grand. Three red running lions on a blue ground. The tents were of the latest brand, and the whole appearance of camped army and leader might have been a shock to some, but Robert was dumb with admiration, and it all seemed to him perfectly correct, because he knew no more of heraldry or archaeology than the gifted artists who usually drew pictures for the historical romances. The scene was indeed exactly like a picture. He admired it all so much that he felt braver than ever. "Come hither, lad," said the glorious leader, when the men in Cromwellian steel caps had said a few low, eager words, and he took off his helmet, because he could not see properly with it on. He had a kind face, and long, fair hair. "Have no fear, thou shalt take no scathe," he said. Robert was glad of that. He wondered what scathe was, and if it was nastier than the senna tea which he had to take sometimes. "Unfold thy tale without alarm," said the leader kindly. "Whence comest thou, and what is thy intent?"
"I want," said Robert.
"What seekest thou to accomplish?
What is thy errand?"
"That thou wanderest here alone among these rough men at arms." "Poor child, my mother's heart aches for thee, even now, I'll warrant me." "I don't think so," said Robert. "You see, she doesn't know I'm out." The leader wiped away a magic tear, exactly as a leader in a historical romance would have done, and said, "Fear not to speak the truth, my child. Thou hast naught to fear from Wolfric to Talbot." Robert had a wild feeling that this glorious leader of the besieging party, being himself part of a witch, would be able to understand better than Martha or the gypsies or the policeman in Rochester or the clergyman of yesterday the true tale of the wishes and the Samiat. The only difficulty was that he knew he could never remember enough coffers and beshrewies and things like that to make his talk sound like the talk of a boy in a historical romance. However, he began boldly enough with a sentence straight out of Ralph de Courcy or the Boy Crusader. He said, "Gramercy for thy courtesy, fair sir knight. The fact is, it's like this, and I hope you're not in a hurry, because the story's rather a breather. Father and mother are away, and when we were down playing in the sand pits, we found the Samiad." "I cry thee mercy, the Samiad," said the knight. "Yes, a sort of a fairy or enchanter. Yes, that's it, an enchanter. And he said we could have ever wish every day, and we wished first to be beautiful. My wish was ears granted, muttered one of the men-at-arms looking at Robert, who went on as if he had not heard, though he thought the remark very rude indeed. And then we wished for money, treasure, you know, but we couldn't spend it. And yesterday we wished for wings, and we got them. We had a ripping time to begin with. My speech is strange and uncouth, said Sir Walter to Talbot. Repeat thy words. What hadst thou? A ripping, I mean a jolly. No, we were contented with our lot. That's for me only. After that, we got into an awful fix. What is a fix? A fray, mayhap? No, not a fray. A tight place. A dungeon? Alas, boys, without a glimpse, said the knight with polite sympathy. It wasn't a dungeon. We just encountered undeserved misfortunes, Robert explained. And today we're punished by not being able to go out. That's where I live. He pointed to the castle. The others are in there, and they're not allowed to go out. It's all Samiot. I mean, the enchanter thought. I wish we'd never seen him. He's an enchanter of mine. Oh, yes, of might and main, rather. And there are deemest that it is the spells of the enchanter king thou hast angered. That have lent strength to the besieging party, said the gallant leader. But know thou the dwarf that Talbot needs no enchanter's aid to lead his followers to victory. No, I truly don't, said Robert, with hasty courtesy. Of course not, you wouldn't, you know. But all the same, it's partly his fault. But we're most to blame. He couldn't have done anything if it hadn't been for us. Oh no, old boy, asked Sir Wilfred haughtily. My speech is dark, and eke scarce courteous. Unravel me this riddle. Oh, said Robert desperately. Of course, you don't know it, but you are not real at all. You're only here because the others must have been idiots enough to wish for a castle. And when the sun sets, you'll just vanish away, and it'll be all right. The captain and the men at arms exchanged glances, at first pitying, and then sterner, as the longest-witted man said. Beware, though, O my lord, the urchin doth but feign madness to escape from our clutches. Shall we not bind him? I'm no more mad than you are, said Robert angrily. Perhaps not so much. Only I was an idiot to think you'd understand anything. Let me go. I haven't done anything to you. Whither? Asked the knight, who seemed to have believed all the enchanter story till it came to his own share in it. Whither wouldst thou wend? an idea, and let me go somewhere else. His mind sought vaguely among his memories of the historical Romans. Sir Walfred de Talbot, he said slowly, should think fowls corn to keep a check. I mean, one who has done him no hurt. When he wants a cut of blood, I mean, to depart without violence. This to my face, truly for a knave, replied Sir Walfred. But the appeal seems to have gone home. Thou sayest, sooth, he had him softly, go where thou wilt, he said nobly, thou art free. Wolfred de Talbot warreth not with babes, and take him here shall bear thee company. All right, said Robert warmly, Jakey will enjoy himself, I think. Come on, Jakey. Sir Walfred, I salute thee. He saluted after the modern military manner and set off running to the sand pit, Jenkins' long boots keeping up easily. He found the fairy. He dug it up. He woke it up. He implored it to give him one more wish. I've done two today already, it grumbled, and one was a stiffer bit of work than ever I did. Oh, do, said Robert, while Jakin looked on with an expression of open-mouthed horror at the strange beast that talked and gazed with its snail's eyes at him. Well, what is it? Snapped the Samian with cross sleepiness. I'll show us with the others, said Robert, and the Samian began to swell. Robert never thought of wishing the castle and the siege away. Of course he knew they had all come out of a wish. But swords and daggers and pikes and lances seemed much too real to be wished away. Robert lost consciousness for an instant. When he opened his eyes, the others were crowding round him. We never heard you come in, they said. How awfully jolly of you to wish it to give us our wish. Of course we understood that was what you'd done. But you ought to have told us. Suppose we'd wished something silly. Silly? Said Robert very crossly indeed. How much sillier could you have been, I'd like to know. You nearly settled me, I can tell you. Then he told his story, and the others admitted that it certainly had been rough on him. But they praised his courage and cleverness so much that he presently got back his lost temper and felt braver than ever, and consented to be captain of the besieged force. We haven't done anything yet, said Anthea, comfortably. We waited for you. We're going to shoot at them through these little loopholes of the bow and arrows Uncle gave you. You shall have first shot.
I don't think I would,
said Robert, cautiously. You don't know what they're like near to. They've got real bows and arrows, awful legs, and swords, and pikes, and daggers, and all sorts of sharp things. They're all quite real. It's not just a picture or a vision or anything. They can hurt us, or kill us even, I shouldn't wonder. I can feel my ear all sore still. Look here, have you explored the castle? Because I think we'd better let them alone, as long as they let us alone. I heard that Jakin man say they weren't going to attack until just after sundown. We can be getting ready for the attack. Are there any soldiers in the castle to defend it? We don't know, said Cyril. You see, directly ambushed, we were in a besieged castle. Everything seems to go upside down. And when it came straight, we looked out the window and saw the camp and things. And you, and of course you kept on looking at everything. Isn't this room jolly? This is real, it's real. It was. It was square. The stone walls, 4 feet thick, and great beams for ceiling. A low door at the corner led to a flight of steps, up and down. The children went down. They found themselves in a great arched gatehouse. The enormous doors were shut and barred. There was a window in a little room at the bottom of the round turret, up which the stair wound. Rather larger than the other windows. And looking through it, they saw that the drawbridge was up and the portcullis down. The moat looked very wide and deep. Opposite the great door that led to the moat was another great door, with a little door in it. The children went through this and found themselves in a big paved courtyard with the great grey walls of the castle rising dark and heavy on all four sides. Near the middle of the courtyard stood Martha, moving her right hand backwards and forwards in the air. The cook was stooping down and moving her hands also in a very curious way. Of the oddest and at the same time most terrible thing was the lamb, who was sitting on nothing about 3 feet from the ground, laughing happily. The children ran towards him. Just as Anthea was reaching out her arms to take him, Martha said crossly, "Let him alone, do, miss, when he's good." "But what's he doing?" said Anthea. "Doing? A sitting in his high chair as good as gold and precious, watching me doing of the art. Get along with you two. My iron's cold again." She went towards the cook and seemed to poke invisible fire with an unseen poker. The cook seemed to be putting an unseen dish into an invisible oven. "Run along with you two," she said. "I'm behindhand as it is. You won't get no dinner if you come hindering me like this. Come, off you goes, or I'll pin a dishcloth to some of your tails."
"You sure the lamb's all right?"
constantly of him. I thought you'd like to be rid of him for today, but seek him if you want him, for gracious sake.
No, no,
they said and hastened away. They would have to defend the castle presently, and the lamb was safer, even suspended in midair in an invisible kitchen, than in the guardroom of a besieged castle. They went through the first doorway they came to, and sat down helplessly on a wooden bench that ran along the room inside.
Thank you.
not my mother. It wasn't. But they hung around, watching the strange movements of the servants in the middle of the courtyard. Because of course they couldn't be sure where the dining room of the Inn and Resort House was. Presently, they saw Martha carrying an invisible tray across the courtyard. For it seemed that, by the most fortunate accident, the dining room of the house and the banqueting hall of the castle were in the same place. And oh, how their hearts sank when they perceived the tray was invisible. They waited in wretched silence while Martha went through the form of carving an unseen leg of mutton and serving invisible greens and potatoes with a spoon that no one could see. When she had left the room, the children looked at the empty table and then at each other. "This is worse than anything," said Robert, who had not, till now, been particularly keen on his dinner. "I'm not so very hungry," said Anthea, trying to make the best of things as usual. Cyril tightened his belt ostentatiously.